Welcome to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a 5-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. And welcome, everyone, to the first podcast for the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast of the year 2023. This is Chase, as always, joined by Nick. Nick, how are you doing?
Doing great, Chase. I hope everybody had a happy new year. Just back in Houston here, and it's about 75 degrees, so it's kind of the time of year where you're like, okay, this is why I live in the South, right?
So yeah, right. And here in Phoenix, it's actually, you know, a little chillier on the chillier side, getting the desert winter. So the good news is that 2022 closed out a very strong year. The bad news is that 2023 has not been great so far. So just a really quick, you know, reminder to everyone, USC basketball was on the Washington trip, which is, look, traditionally these road trips are always difficult. I'm not sure that Washington is necessarily harder or easier than any of them, because when you're talking about the mountain schools, Oregon schools, I mean, these are just tough trips to make. Obviously, when you Arizona would be an easier trip, but for the fact that you have one of the most difficult venue in the conference, McHale, to play when you go on that trip. So back when, you know, when I, during my more formative years, the Bay Area was actually a very daunting trip because Cal and Stanford were both really good. But these days, that's the easiest trip. Washington is somewhere in the middle. You never know which school is going to be necessarily be tougher up there. Clearly it was Washington State, because SC was able to beat Washington in the final game of 2022. But to open on New Year's Day, Sunday, SC lost to Washington State in Pullman, home of the biggest spree killer of 2022. And then the following day we lose the Cotton Bowl to Tulane, now making SC 0-4 in Texas over the last several years. By the way, this is the first time I was at the first three games where we went 0-3 twice at AT&T and once in Austin. Yep. I thought we were going to get out of it and we didn't. But let's start out with basketball. Friday, I think Tim Floyd used up the saying that, you know, what you want to do is win at home, split on the road. Okay, that's all good. Certainly, Washington trip is not easy. But if you, depending on what aspirations you have, and these days, Pac-12 is no guarantee. 12-6 in Pac-12. Right? This, I guess, would be 13-7. It's a little bit tricky now because there's 20 games. It's not necessarily a guarantee of an NCAA berth for SC. Probably would be, but I can't say that for sure. But the win against Washington was important. It was a good one. Comeback kind of lay a bit of an egg on Sunday against Washington State. I should say UCLA also struggled with Washington State. They ended up beating them by one. They had a much easier time with Washington, and I bring that up also not only because they're our travel partner, but because we play them tomorrow. But let's just talk about these two games. Nick, what are your takeaways from Washington State?
Yeah, I would say, like, overall, it's like a stock and control road trip. Overall, just kind of a stock neutral trip. They're decent teams, Washington Wazoo. Neither are great. If you can keep the trend up of winning at home and splitting on the road for the remaining games, you're probably going to make the tournament. But then again, like, beating UCLA at home and Arizona at home are going to be challenges. So if you mark those two in as losses at home, but then get the rest of them, I guess that would put you at, 13-7, right, in league. That probably would get you in. Like, that would be outperforming the analytic expectations for the team. So I do think, like, you're kind of on pace, but it's definitely a missed opportunity, right? Like, if you would have won that Washington State game, you know, even if you throw away the UCLA game tomorrow, you know, you're in a pretty good spot to, you know, start 5-1 in conference play, right? And now it's kind of looking more like 4-2, and still a good start, but you know, it was unfortunate to see one slip away there.
Yeah, and just talking a little bit about the Washington game first. This was a game, maybe Boogie's potentially his best game ever as a Trojan. He scored 27 points, really led us. But we also got offensive contributions from Trey White again. Joshua Morgan had a really nice game, especially early on. I think this game definitely cemented in my mind that the Washington Huskies are going to struggle. They're not as good as last year. We saw some points in that game when Keon Menefield, their freshman, kind of, you know, I've talked about him on this podcast before. I was impressed when I've seen him. Then he kind of went through a lull period, I think in December, but he kind of razzle-dazzled against us. We had some odd mountain. I guess they were trying to preserve Boogie's for the foul issues, but we had Drew guarding him. So the weird thing about playing this game was we seemed to switch between either a zone defense, which Washington was actually pretty effective against and hitting threes, and then a man-to-man defense, but putting Drew on Menefield. And it was not until whenever it was the last there was a point in that game, obviously, where Washington actually took the lead and was had the probability to win and was kind of holding on the lead until about the 9.5 minute mark. And then over the last total 10 minutes of the game, SEL scores Washington by 16 points, holding Washington. And Washington had by far the lowest scoring output of between the 10-minute segments and that last 10-minute segment. USC had its best. A couple things happened. One, we didn't really play too many. We didn't play the subs. But two, we stopped. We just basically played man-to-man defense and let Boogie guard Menefield. Once that happened, it was like the disparity of the two teams was so prevalent. It was like we were almost like we played so much of this game, almost like with the arm tied behind our back, switching between this like really ineffective zone defense and then an effective man-to-man defense, except their point guard, who was, you know, obviously, I mean, I like Drew for doing a lot of things. I don't like him for guarding quick point guards. So once we got that together, it was like game over. We went easily.
Yeah. No, there's no doubt about it. And so I know I totally agree. And like Boogie, like, you know, his shot making was pretty exceptional in the Washington game too. I mean, he just kind of played like an all Pac-12 guard, and certainly like one of his better performances in a USC uniform. I think there's no doubt about it.
So, and then not as good outcome, obviously, on Sunday. I know you missed a little bit of the early part of the game, then finally tuned in. Obviously, Washington State was extremely hot from three, but I will say, I mean, they hit 14 to 29, which is, no matter the circumstances, that's always very impressive. That being said, I don't know of any of the 14 threes they hit the entire game if even one of them was contested. We did contest some of their threes, but I think they missed every single time we contested. I could be wrong about that. I'd have to go back and check. But this was a lot of open looks we gave to them in that game. They averaged 1.25 points per possession. I mean, that is a lot for that team. Okay, so I'm going to get a little bit critical of just the way we planned for this game. You know, coming in, one of the strength of Washington State kind of has been the season that, okay, if you leave a guy like Mullins open, he's going to hit his threes. He's shooting a very high percentage. Justin Powell, the point guard transfer for Tennessee, who we've talked about in other podcasts, shoots a pretty decent percentage from three, especially if he's open. Bamba has shot great from three if he's open. And then also DJ Rodman had not been shooting as well, but shot very well against UCLA. And we kind of just left those guys open. Rodman went 3-for-6. Powell, who was just, I mean, we could go and I could probably do an entire podcast about how we didn't guard him, went 4-for-7. Jakimovsky, who was kind of just, you know, hasn't been playing for most of the season, he hurt us again. He hit two threes. Mullins went 4-for-6. The only guy who actually didn't shoot very great was Bamba from three. But for the most part, all their guys were just hitting from three. And we kind of played into that. The point guards, I mean, they use Justin Powell. Sometimes they use Bamba. Neither one of them are particularly strong ball handlers. And we kind of let those guys off the hook. We did not pressure them a ton. We only caused 9 turnovers, and 4 of those were like team turnovers for Washington State. So there were only 5 individual turnovers by the Washington State players in that game. In the previous game where UCLA was really struggling against Washington State and then had to kind of mount a furious comeback, in that game, Washington State had 14 turnovers, 13 turnovers by individual players, including 3 by Bamba, 3 by Powell, 3 by Huensu. We just didn't really get into them, and we didn't really pressure them too much. And I think that's like the to me, that's the difference in the game. I mean, offensively, 1.09 points per possession. It's not dynamite, but it's better than our average for the season. We just didn't kind of bring it on the defensive end.
Yeah, I mean, it's all the three-point line, right? Like, you know, you look at them, they were 14 and 29, and then conversely, like, we were 3 for 18, right? So they hit 11 more and attempted, let's see, 11 more, right? So if you have an extra 11 possessions, they make a 3 every time. I mean, that's how you get a 10-point loss on the road up there. Yeah, like I think part of it is personnel issues. Like we don't have the twitchy guards outside of like maybe Boogie, right? If you were just to look at our lineup, right, I guess the best defensive lineup would be probably Boogie at the 1, Kobe at the 2, and Trey White at the 3, right? And I'm kind of curious how that lineup did. Because several of our lapses were when, you know, we would put recent, right, he'd have a mental lapse and they get a 3 or a layup, oftentimes a 3. Some of it I think is the way we guarded ball screens, just kind of like, you know, let them walk into threes. And then you do have to give them some credit too, right? Like hitting, they probably hit what, 70% of uncontested threes in that game. And, you know, that's a pretty good percentage right there too. So, you know, they went out and took it. I guess positives from the game, we were really good on the offensive glass. I thought probably our best offensive rebounding game of the season. We were okay on turnovers, kind of that was a wash, but you know, it is interesting, right? Because early on in the year, even probably as recent as within the last 2 weeks, you noticed our rebounding was really bad, right? Our defensive rebounding was really bad and our offensive rebounding was really bad. And now those two have kind of diverged. Now our offensive rebounding is actually top 50% of teams, whereas our defensive rebounding is still really bad. So that's kind of interesting. I guess my last thought is just Josh Morgan taking like 15 to 18 footers is not a good shot. Just in general, like that should not happen. And maybe some of that is the coaching staff giving him additional leeway to keep him engaged defensively because he's really good on defense. But, you know, he goes 5 for 11 against Washington State. I think a couple of those 5 were on dunks, right? So it's just a low percentage shot that, you know, you can't have happen in tight games.
Yeah. So a couple notes. One before the game, right after the Washington game, you asked me who would you rather have, Joshua Morgan or Muhammad Gay, and I said, oh, for our team, Morgan. But then right, we come right back and Gay just outplayed him. I mean, there's no two ways about that. He outplayed him badly. No one really on our team had like a positive plus minus for the game, except for Boogie, and interestingly, Kajani Wright. For whatever reason, and I don't know if it's because they took Gay out of the game when Joshua Morgan sat, because it also applied to those 3 possessions Niagu played, but Washington State didn't score as much when Morgan went to the bench for whatever reason. The other guy who had not as much of a negative impact as compared to everybody else was Kobe. That's no surprise. And Drew for the game. Both Reese and Joshua Morgan really struggled. Actually, Morgan, even I'm kind of shocked, struggled more than Reese did. Offense was decent with Reese in there. In another thing, nine possessions, Malik Thomas. We had our best offensive showing, but we also had a worse defensive showing.
Yeah.
So, and that's a lot. You're seeing that. I do think, you know, maybe we'll talk about recruiting a little bit here, and at some point we're gonna hit the one way or the other on Malik Thomas. I do like a lot of the things I'm seeing from him, but yeah, we're struggling on defense, and there's a lot of misassignments when he's out there, and then guys will hit threes. That's always a concern. So yeah, overall, just not a great defensive performance. But yeah, going through the numbers, it is, you know, we rebounded. Offensive rebounding was really strong. Defensive rebounding was pretty good, not bad.
Good enough.
Right? Good enough. Yeah. Obviously, three-point shooting was dismal, but, you know, we shot 53% from inside the arc, and we didn't take a lot of threes. Didn't have a lot of assists, not great ball movement. Didn't turn the ball over a ton compared to what we normally do. You know, it was – Washington State shot the free throws and they hit those threes. So yeah, just a really, really probably worst defensive. Again, I think it was our worst defensive performance this season. Maybe Florida Gulf Coast ranks up there. So look, it's going to be a setback for the team. Now we have UCLA coming up. We had gotten up to like 63 again and KenPom, we're down to 67. You know, we're at Pauley. That's a tough, tough game. I don't know. Do we know if Amari Bailey is playing in that game? Because he sat out against Washington State, and I think he sat out against Washington. They didn't really need him against Washington. He kind of UCLA just cleaned up in that game.
I haven't heard either way on it. But do you think Amari Bailey playing, is that worth more than a point either way? I mean,
well, it actually might help UCLA because of the way Singleton shoots threes.
Right.
The only thing he does bring to the table is he does bring this risk of like fast break points that you don't see that Singleton is not going to bring to you. But you know, I think Singleton overall is probably the better player right now. It's like, you just have to play Bailey. You know, it's going to be a tough game. I don't know exactly how we guard Hawkes. I don't know if it's like trying to do a mix of Morgan and Trey White. I'm just not sure exactly what we do. Maybe Kobe is guarding Hawkes and we just do our best there. The other thing is, you can't, you know, with Tiger Campbell, you can't just like put like Drew on him to preserve Boogie from getting fouls and like hope for the best. I mean, Tiger will eat you alive if you do that. So it's going to be a tough game. UCLA is a really well-coached team, and they just play a different level of defensive intensity at times than we do. And you know, the good thing is we usually play really hard. Now maybe that's limited as a little bit because we're playing a Pauley, but I think the guys will come out hard. I'm just not sure over time. You know, we've struggled at times to score the 3-point line. You just give Singleton a few, you know, some open looks, and he can score 9 points on you like that. So that does concern me. But
yeah. KenPom is losing by 15. So I would lower expectations going into this one. I don't think it'll be that competitive. UCLA is really good. Like, they might be the best team in the country. I think it's probably them or UConn. Houston's in that mix too. But I think they're better than Tennessee and even Arizona. Just not a lot of weaknesses on either side of the ball. I mean, they turn you over, they rebound pretty well. You know, they don't turn the ball over, so they, you know, they're going to dominate the turnover battle. Their forced turnover rate is almost double the amount of times they turn the ball over. So they're just, you know, it's a sign of good guard play, senior leadership. Cronin's still doing kind of that isolation offense, and it's working for them because, like, A, it's a way they keep the turnovers down. B, you got Singleton hitting 50% of his threes this year on kickouts. And, you know, you have Hawkes who can win ISO possessions at, you know, a really high rate. I mean, he's shooting 58% from two this year and 82% from the line. So you can't foul him this year either. And then defensively, like, they just make it really uncomfortable. Clark is, you know, maybe the best defender in America, definitely up there. at least the best wing defender. So he makes it really tough, kind of both on and off the ball. They've got Bona on their back line, who's kind of emerging. And then Jaime is always tough too. So yeah, I don't really see a win here. I think the only way they win is if Boogie or Drew just has a really, really good individual shot making game, including hitting some tough, like difficult threes. I think that's probably the only way here.
Yeah. And if you look at, like, you know, they lost two games this season. Both of them were tight games. Both of them kind of were coin flip type games to Baylor and to Illinois. In the Baylor game, UCLA just could not hit outside shots. They hit 4 out of 15. That's something that if SC really was impressive about guarding the three but not giving up too much on the inside, that I could see that being helpful. Illinois was a kind of a strange game because UCLA had a big lead in that one, and that's the one where the Illini just came marching back. Really kind of had a athleticism advantage over UCLA. I don't know if SC can take advantage of, can really rely on that kind of same, you know, athleticism advantage. What happened in that game, which was very unusual for UCLA, was not that they got cold from the outside, they got cold from the inside. And Illinois was just challenging a lot of shots at the rim, and UCLA was struggling. Hawkes 7 for 18 from the two from inside the arc. Tiger Campbell 5 for 14 from inside the arc. Bailey Bagel 0 for 3. So they just struggled. Dylan Clark 3 for 8 from inside the arc. They just struggled around the rim. Maybe there's a scenario where Morgan can do enough here, but I don't know if Morgan on his own can do enough, and he's likely to get into foul trouble to boot. So yeah, I'm not a huge fan of this matchup for us.
Yeah, one other quick note too on that Illinois thing. They actually, and maybe like this isn't game tape you can take, but they pressed UCLA, and UCLA turned it over 15 times. Tiger actually had 5 turnovers on his own. So they kind of caught them off guard, and I think Cronin fixed that just given how low their turnover rate is now. Like, they've been really good at taking care of the ball since then. They also had just kind of a fluky shooting game. So Terrence Shannon was 8 for 9 for 3 in that game. The dude just couldn't miss. And, you know, I think it would take something like Peterson doing something like that, or Bogey, kind of one of those two guys. But, you know, like, I kind of like the way our press has looked in a way. I mean, I think we can speed teams up a little bit just given like Boogie and Kobe's athleticism. So maybe that's something we get more of an extended look at tomorrow night.
Yeah. The only, my only concern is, you leave Singleton open threes if you press.
Yeah.
And he had 4 of those against Illinois. So you just got to, it's hard to be both aggressive and to guard against the three on the back end, which you need to do.
Yep.
Especially, I mean, it's one thing to, okay, you can give Hawkes an open look from three. He'll hit some, he'll miss some. Like, Singleton's going to hit like 85% if you leave him open. So that's tough, really tough. Okay. So, and we haven't heard anything more when we expect, Vince Uchukwu back. I guess let's talk a little bit about personnel and how things are looking and recruiting and things like that. So we have a class obviously signed for 2023, but it may not be complete. We have Isaiah Collier coming in with his teammate, high school teammate, Arrington Page. And then we have Silas Demery coming in as another kind of point guard, combo guard type. I don't, you know, we, I hate speculating on who will be back and won't be back, but we've obviously haven't, you know, for example, Harrison Hornery is now in his second year in the program, and we're struggling to find minutes where he can contribute positively. And somebody, we're basically, you know, we even tried playing him at the 5 because I don't think there was the confidence we could play him so much at the 4. That kind of, that didn't really work out. We obviously have Uwuchukwu coming back. I think we'll have a couple more spots even for next season. So there's some 2024 guys we want to talk about, but for 2023, the talk has been Bronny James. So I guess before we talk about his game, let's just talk about what we've reliably heard as to whether or not SC's interested. We've heard SC's interested, but there's already been direct communication that he understands that he's not, in all likelihood, will not be coming in a starting role. So there is a complication here because Bronny James is not your typical high school recruit. He is the son of one of the all-time greatest NBA players who's still playing and has expressed a strong interest to play with his son in the NBA, which makes it far more likely that Bronny will be a one-and-done player, even if he's not really a one-and-done type talent. So, Nick, you and I have gone back and forth on this as him as a take, not as a take. I should say as a rep for the record, my position on Bronny James is, you know, if this was an ordinary recruit and we projected him as a four-year player, I'd be very intrigued. And, you know, I might be on the take side, but all these other factors weigh against him. I think you have a different opinion, so I'll let you express your opinion.
Yeah. So this is strictly on him as a player. I think the LeBron factor complicates things. And I think lots of programs have been kind of unwilling to get involved there just because of the circus aspect. And I totally understand that. Like, you know, it's not great to be on First Take every day, and you don't want like LeBron, you know, out there making public comments about your program or playing time or anything like that. So I think there's, you know, an element there that you have to vet and feel comfortable before recruiting him. But I do think he does a lot of winning things on the court. I think he's a very quick decision maker. He, you know, the ball doesn't really stop in his hands unless he's going to shoot it. He doesn't turn the ball over, which is huge. You see so many players try to do too much and throw it away. And any kind of shot is better than a turnover. I think you look at, like, how has Wisconsin basketball been so good for so long? A lot of it is they just year after year, they take care of the ball and don't turn it over. Bad programs, you know, they turn it over a lot. So I think he's really good in that aspect. I think he can attack closeouts. I don't think he's like a, you know, shot creator off the dribble, or he's going to like, you know, take two dribble pull-ups into a mid range. I do think like he can, if he gets an advantage or a step on a guy, I think he can attack the rim. I really trust his shooting mechanics. I think as a catch and shoot jump shooter, especially when you have a point guard like Isaiah Collier creating for him, I think he could help you there. I do think he's a good defender. I don't think he's like a Kobe Johnson level defender or anything like that. And I'm not even willing to say he'd be better than Silas Demery, who I think has shown a lot of flashes on defense as well, but pretty good in man. And then I've seen him get some off-ball steals as well. So I think he could help you there and not get overwhelmed. So I don't think he's as good on the ball as lots of guards in this class, but I do think he makes a lot of winning plays. Is a team player, doesn't try to do too much, and kind of because of that aspect, because he's not an on-ball guy, isn't going to shoot you out of games, and is actually more scalable to winning as a freshman in your basketball program than lots of these other higher ranked players. Is it ideal to have that guy as a one and done? No, but I do think he could play minutes and help your team win. And then, you know, you do see just a lot of the LeBron like basketball IQ parts of his game too. And just in terms of, you know, he knows when to back cut. He's just really advanced in processing the game as well. So just lots of winning traits overall. But again, like the whole LeBron aspect of the thing, you definitely have to vet before kind of going all in on him.
Okay. So, and I probably should present a little bit of the other side of the coin, just as the LeBron stuff aside, and just him as a recruit and a prospect. So he is, I believe, ranked right around number 40 in the country as far as recruits go. I have to say that I think it was 40. I think he's 40 in the 247 rankings, and composite, he's 43. He is a guard, and I don't think I have ever seen a top 40 guard that I can remember be as kind of, I mean, I think you would call him efficient and patient. I might stretch to say that he's passive. I don't think I've ever seen a top 40 guard quite as passive on both the offense and defensive side. So it is 100% true that he does not He is not a high usage guy. He does not. He's in that way. He's actually very much unlike his dad. He is not a ball He is not a ball dominator.
No, not at all.
He does not come out there like, hey, I'm going to dribble the ball around for, you know, 30 seconds, then pass it to somebody with 5 seconds left on the shot clock and hope he hits a shot. He is not like that at all. He is a completely different style of player, but it's almost to the point of passivity. And I think it's more than almost to the point. So, for example, Sierra Canyon, who he plays for, which is obviously one of the very best high school programs, that's not like a true prep school in the country, went up to play a tournament in Portland this past weekend, and they played the high school where Peyton Pritchard went, Westland High School in Oregon, which is really one of the only programs that actually produces any Division I talent. And they have a prospect there that who's a point guard who's going to play basketball at Oregon, named Shelstead. Jackson Shelstead. They have Jackson another Shelstead. Yeah, and they have another guard who I have not seen actually being recruited, but he's a senior named Mosley. And these two guys scored, I think Shelstead scored 38 and Mosley scored like 28 against Sierra Canyon, and Westland won really for fun. And the entire game, I don't think I saw Bronny make any kind of meaningful play on the defensive end while these two guards scoring like 66 points against this team. Now, he was not guarding these guys man to man. Of course, that kind of raised the question, like, why wasn't he? But, you know, coach's decision, what have you. But he's not really an alpha on offense or defense. He's just kind of like, he's on the court. If you give him the ball, he'll be efficient with it. But he is not, he does not seem to have a huge, huge motor, which scares me a little bit about him. But, you know, look, if he was a multi-year prospect, I think he could be like really interesting, because I think he's the kind of guy that could really improve himself over time, because he is like, he can jump really well. He has great mechanics. He does not have a lot of like throwaway energy in his game. He has no desire to like dominate the ball and take teams out of their rhythm. He could be super, super effective. I just question whether or not he's going to be able to do that in one season. And if he's going to come in, is he going to be expected to take minutes away from, I guess, Malik Thomas next season? I mean, so those are my concerns, and I'll let you respond, Nick.
Yeah. You know, there's totally fair. I think the question with him is just, given the fact that he's a likely one and done, like, how much can you realistically expect, you know, as a freshman, right? Because that's the conversation here. I do think he has gotten better. I mean, like, in this same, you know, Portland tournament, he had two other games where he went 9 of 11 from three, went 16 of 21 from the fields. Didn't turn the ball over in either game. And like, yeah, I mean, it's lesser competition, but you do watch like
some. Yeah, but we have to be lesser. Everyone understands these are like high school, Catholic high schools in the state of Oregon, just so everyone understands. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, you're not playing D1 guys, right? You know, like, you watch the tape and there are some, like, you know, movement threes and some plays where, you know, back cuts and throws down dunks and gets above the rim. And he has some transition plays kind of going coast to coast. And, you know, it kind of reminds you like a little bit of Josh Green in Arizona, like in terms of the athleticism and kind of overall package. He's not as tall as Josh, but he probably is as explosive. I don't think he's like the level of defender that Josh is, because Josh is really good on D, but, you know, Green was like a one and done guy who is like an okay role player in the NBA. So I think, you know, like I would take Josh going in between the two, but, you know, there are kind of some similarities in their games. But yeah.
Like, I mean, do you think, know, so? I mean, Josh was a three. Do you think Bronny is a three or is he a two?
No, I think he's kind of like the shooting guard version, right? Like, okay. He's kind of like Josh Green light, but you know, I do think both are pretty good transition players. Like Bronny, like over the summer, he had a play, you know, where he went coast to coast and dunked over a guy. So yeah, like, I don't know. I think the whole like lack of alpha thing is, I think there's, you know, there are points there, and I think some of it's fair, but do you really want a guy coming in as a freshman if they're not a top 10 recruit, like with that alpha personality, first off? And then kind of second off, right, the same concerns were made about Evan Mobley, where his senior year stats at Rancho Christian weren't that good, right? And there was
right, but he did average like 11 rebounds and 3 blocks per game.
Defensively, right? But right, like on offense, right? I mean, it wasn't there. Like,
yeah, I think he scored like 18. There. Yeah, 18 and a half. He absolutely did not dominate in high school. I think part of that was just because I think he just saw the writing on the wall and it wasn't like that important to him to, do, because he knew like they weren't going to win state or anything like that. It is strange to watch, because when you watch Sierra Canyons, there'll be times you're watching the game and you might even forget he's out there on the court because they have they have an ensemble cast of players. So they're supposed to be playing in this event right at Galen Center. Is that correct?
Think so, against Wheeler, right? That's coming up.
I don't know. Let me check really quick. By the way, as I'm checking, I think there was a tweet that went out today that Amari Bailey is not playing. So for better or for worse, I think that like I mentioned, I think that that cuts both ways. For UCLA, because David Singleton is he's great off the bench. So Sierra Canyon and Wheeler at Galen, I think they're coming 11 p.m. Eastern tip. So it is I know this makes for riveting podcasting as I'm literally doing research in real time. Forgive me, everyone. The NFSS HS network. Okay. So I guess it's this weekend. I don't know. These I love it when like someone writes this story and like they tell you the time of the game and the date of the game at completely different parts of the article. I think it's Saturday, January 7th. Okay. So it is on Saturday. So, maybe that's something people can stream and watch. I'm sure there'll be replay on YouTube. I'm very curious to see, Bronny in this game, and maybe he'll really impress me and I'll be like, ah, this is interesting. You want to talk a little bit about 2024 recruits?
Yeah, let's just talk about Victorious Miller. So I know we've mentioned him like a little bit before, probably over the summer. He is a top ranked 2024 recruit. There's been some talk of a reclassification in 2023, but I think that's died down a bit. So I guess, Chase, have you seen any of Victorious's game? Do you have any kind of strong?
I watched one of his games. It's been a while. For context, everybody, this is Percy Miller's little cousin? Romeo's cousin, right. I believe. So the Miller name, it's part of this. So there's already a connection to USC here, and is he at Compass right now?
He's at Compass, and obviously, most people listening probably know of the Romeo Miller DeMar DeRozan connection, but he's referred to DeMar DeRozan, this is Victorious, as his uncle. So like there are lots of ties to the university.
So it's been a while since I've watched him play. So why don't you give me your take on I remember actually the last time I did watch, I was actually pretty impressed. What are your thoughts on his game? Do you think he's a one and done? I think that does impact a little bit on, how excited people should be. Not because we should definitely take a guy that's standing, but like, is he someone who's going to be ready year one to come in and, make a huge impact? And is he going to be off, or what's his deal?
Yeah, I don't quite think he's one and done good. He just doesn't quite have that athleticism. He's a good athlete. He's pretty quick, but a lot of what he does, he's a good passer, pretty good shooter. He can hit mid range. He's got pretty good positional size. I mean, Rivals lists him as 6'6", and he's kind of a shooting guard. I don't think he's 6'6". He's probably 6'5", but. Even then, I think he has a good chance of playing the NBA, but I think we'll need a little bit more development than one and done. So ideally you get him as a multi-year guy. You probably, I think, should be rated in the 20s somewhere, is where I'd have him based on what I've seen of him. But it can get a little bit dangerous with those guys because they might think they're one and done good, even if they're not kind of one and done level. But I'd probably put him in the same kind of tier as Trey White, where you get good minutes from them as a freshman, and then they can kind of blossom into NBA players over their second and third seasons.
Yeah, and I completely agree. And I'm actually just watching some film of him now, so I remember, just refreshing my memory. He's leaner than like Trey White.
Yeah.
One of the things that Trey White's really strong at is like he can rebound as well and really score at the rim. You're not going to want Victorious Miller trying to score too much of the rim. You're going to want him trying to score mid-range and from the outside. He's a good playmaker too, though. He can pass the ball.
Yeah.
But I think he's really more of a true two, you know.
Yeah.
Definitely guy you want. I think I would love it if he was actually rated around like number 30, so he didn't think of himself as a one and done. Because
Yeah.
he doesn't like, you watch him, he does not like flash like, oh my God, this guy needs to be in the NBA tomorrow. I mean, like
Yeah.
one of the things that you one of the ways I try to look at these things, I think I've said this before in the podcast, is with the plays this guy makes, would he be able to make these plays at a higher level of basketball? So a perfect example of this is if you get a guy who's like 6'3" monster on the inside around the rim, and he just, you know, scoring 40 points a game, but he's at the rim, but he's 6'3", you should know, well, this guy's probably, you put him up, the higher the level of basketball goes, the less he's going to be effective at 6'3" scoring at the rim. He does a lot of things that I think he could score, you know, a lot of the scoring he does, he can replicate that at the Division One level. But you know, there's certain things that like are going to be much tougher for him to do, especially since he's got this lean frame. At the NBA level, it would be really tough right now. I mean, he really, I don't say this as he's like never going to get there. I'm just saying, like, if he was truly a one and done, it's hard to project what he's doing now in high school and say, oh, this is gonna, you know, hit, no problem, he'll do this with the Charlotte Hornets too. No, I mean, he's
Yeah.
got, you know, there's
Yeah.
a completely different level to the game that he'd have to achieve to in order to play in the NBA. So I think he's more like, you know, he's not a one and done, and I hope he doesn't see himself that way. Maybe, you know, look, maybe it's the kind of situation that there's potential for an NIL package. I don't know. I
Yeah.
do know that SC has like started making contact again with Zoom Diallo, who I think we thought, if SC's kind of just totally out of it, it was down to Arizona Gonzaga maybe. And he's
Yeah.
a 23 a 2023 point guard. And we I don't know, maybe SC now has like a NIL package lined up that they want to compete for Zoom Diallo. I don't know. I just don't know. And I think Victorious Miller, you're going to need to get an NIL package, but it should be an easy sell because, you know, he's kind of like, got this pre, you know, he's from LA originally, and he's got this pre-existing connection to SC. So he's the kind of guy that's like a perfect candidate to get a great NIL package, to come to SC.
Yeah. I don't know if he's like a rapper at all, like with the whole like Little Romeo thing, but it seems like a kid who would, be kind of an LA kid. I mean, lots of ties, Rivals in their article about him said that should USC decide to press, the Trojans feel like a decent bet to be in this until the end, given the family connection to the school. We'll see if like UCLA makes a bigger move. It seems like they're more focused on Isaiah Elohim. So, and then Arizona's got Jamari Phillips, and they probably are going to get Carter Bryant. So it kind of seems like those three schools are splitting the California talent right now. And those are probably the guys in LA, right? Or in California that are like really good potential high major 2024 prospects. At least from what I've seen, it's Carter Bryant, Isaiah Elohim, Jamari Phillips, and I guess Victorious Miller. So those four have kind of separated themselves, it seems like.
You know, it's I don't know right now. I mean, UCLA has not landed. I guess they did get a commitment from Sebastian Mack after the things
Yeah.
didn't work out with Stojakovic. But UCLA
Yep.
has really struggled to recruit here, and with the under the NIL regime, I don't know if they're going to get that straightened out. I don't think they'll be able to get a kid like Elohim unless they have an NIL package lined up for him. Now, maybe that will be much easier because he's
Yeah.
a local kid. I mean, I would assume it'd be easier sell.
Yeah.
So, you know, they'll be in a better position to get him. But I think that's going to be an ongoing issue there. You know, you still see UCLA connected to European recruiting a lot. Like European players visiting campus constantly there. So I don't know how much that's going to be the direction they go in. They're going to have a really big decision to make after the season, because they have a lot of good players who are not going to be on this team next year. And they have a lot of spots to fill. And to get transfers, you need to have NIL. And we'll see what condition they are in to get NIL. Should we move on to football?
Yeah, I'll just make one final comment though on UCLA. Like, yeah, it's I don't know how you can call their 2023 recruiting class anything but a failure, given how many guys that Rowe reported that they led for that ended up going elsewhere. But them getting Dante Moore, I think that's a decent sign for their NIL, because clearly like they had to bid something there to be competitive with Oregon. So maybe they're starting to figure it out, but you do have like it does seem like they have been behind a lot of these other programs thus far.
That's true, but it is football too. And I know that UCLA is much more of a basketball school, but like football is always king. And bring in Dante Moore, he's coming, he's going to be there for three seasons unless he transfers. If you're dropping a ton of money on an LOE, the idea is he's probably going to be gone after a year. So it's a big financial commitment for one year over the player. That is a big, I think that's a big difference.
No doubt.
Okay. So I don't think this podcast is going to add too much to the everyone's insights about the Cotton Bowl. Clearly we have a major problem with the defense. You asked me a couple podcasts ago what my justification was for not wanting Alex Grinch fired as defensive coordinator. Do you remember my answer?
I think you said because he's going to be the defensive coordinator.
That's exactly what my answer was. I no longer think that's a sure thing. I did hear some information today that made me pretty depressed, because it seemed I have multiple connections give me information about different things. And I have one person in particular who has like one or two connections with Heritage Hall where they get information, and they got information regarding the retention or non-retention of Grinch as defensive coordinator. And honestly, the talking points that were coming out from this connection at Heritage Hall was like the exact same deflection talking points we got from, Clay Helton era, the Pat Hayden decisions, Sark being hired. I mean, what have you, this goes obviously all the way. This goes all the way back to Norm Chow being fired by Pete Carroll, but certainly, it also connects to, the decision to have Lane Kiffin come in with his dad and Ed Ogeron to put a staff together, which at the time was also supposed to include Norm Chow, and Kiffin basically pulled a bait and switch on Mike Garrett with that one. Garrett is fired very shortly thereafter. And from there, you get the decision to bring in Sark. First Hayden's decision not to fire Kiffin after the Sun Bowl, and then the decision to bring in Sark, which was remarkable, because I know Hayden had talked to so many people, people I know about this, and people who know football, and told them it was absolutely crazy idea. And Hayden kind of assured them, oh, it's not going to be Sark. And then it was, Mark Jackson talked him into hiring Sark anyway. Also right around the same time, obviously Hayden agrees to this like crazy equal revenue split on the Pac-12 of media rights, which really has crippled SC. All of these terrible decisions one after another, I would, you'd hear this person, my friend who has their connections and to Heritage Hall, and it was always the same talking points, always the same deflections, always the same explaining away the obvious. How obvious things that were clearly indefensible were being defended on just spurious grounds. And with the Grinch thing, what you're hearing is, oh, it's just all about personnel. Now, clearly, personnel is an issue. Nobody's debating whether personnel is an issue. However, you're not going to. Tulane scored more points against us than any of their opponents except for two. And they played in the American Conference. You're not going to convince me that Tulane's talent advantage on their offense is that much greater than our defensive talent. That's clearly, it's not strictly a talent issue. And you know, people kind of tend to put this in, they make these, make it kind of like a binary blame game between talent and scheme. And it's like, oh, well, then it's the scheme. Okay, scheme doesn't help either, because there's a lot of weird things that Prince does on a scheme, which I won't even get into on this podcast. But there's other factors that are involved here. Player development. And that's the number one. It's just developing the players individually and then developing the defense as a whole. There are just so many plays where either a player individually just looks completely unprepared to play on that play, or the defense as a whole just looks totally confused and doesn't understand what it's trying to do. So I just hadn't paid that much attention. I guess maybe I should have. I went back and watched some like mic'd up segments with Alex Grinch or some press conference stuff. And Grinch is an impressive guy. Like, I mean, clearly he's not an idiot. He knows what he's doing. He knows what he's talking about. But one thing I noticed, and this is just my personal observation, he seems to talk like really fast. And like some of the ideas he's communicating when he talks on the defensive side is, it's a lot of defensive lingo. And if you play football, you know, there's like football's full of lingo, but it's not, it is like, it takes you a second. It's like if you're trying to speak a foreign language, even if you speak it decently, you have to think about it for a second. And he speaks so fast. I wonder if like there's a communications issue. Like he's saying things and the players, like they nod their heads, but they don't really understand it. And that's what kind of looks like a lot to me on defense, is like the players just aren't sure exactly what they're supposed to be doing. That causes them to play kind of in a hesitant way, not in a fully attacking way. And then beyond that, obviously, there's just a lot of like poor technique used in tackling. I mean, I've heard the excuse used thrown out today, like, oh, it's not the job of the college coach to teach tackling. BS. That's not true at all. Yes, it is. I mean, yeah, you learn how to tackle in high school, but tackling in college is a whole different level than tackling in high school. Just like tackling in the NFL is a whole different level than tackling in college. So yeah, technique is everything. And you have to have the proper, I mean, Pete Carroll put out a video, I think a couple years ago when all this stuff came out about concussions. Pete Carroll put out a video with his staff talking about all the new, like the, you know, perfect tackling techniques that they're using to try, they're teaching their players at the Seahawks level to make sure they're doing proper tackling techniques so people don't get hurt. So anyway, that's my rant. I'm guessing you probably don't disagree with a lot of the stuff I'm saying.
Yeah, I don't know what I can add. I mean, there was a really good post. I don't know if you saw it. I think it was by like Jason Fink on the Peristyle about just kind of the level of defense you need to win a championship, and basically just how far off USC is, even from 2019 LSU, which had the worst defense to win a title, but their offense with Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase and Justin Jefferson and Clyde Edwards-Helaire, it was just so elite that it didn't matter with them. But yeah, I mean, like, I don't know. I think, do we have any evidence that Lincoln Riley's more than a like glorified, really, really good offensive coordinator at this point in his coaching career? I mean, you know, I think he's still worth it, of course. And the turnaround is impressive, but I mean, it's a mind-boggling decision on so many levels. Like, Alex Grinch, I mean, he hasn't, it's not just this year too. I mean, he's had like really good athletes, at least from a star rating standpoint, at both Ohio State and Oklahoma, and hasn't produced good defenses really, really ever, right? Like, I don't think he's ever had an elite defense. But because he's buddies with Lincoln Riley, you have this like nepotism factor that's keeping him employed. And, you know, it's not like you need to go out and hire a Jim Leonard, as great as I think that would be. Like, you, I think you've talked about this too, just offline. It's just, you need a basic defensive coordinator that understands fundamentals and doesn't have some complex or like NFL level scheme or anything like that, but just, you know, someone that's superior to Grinch, right? If they can get us to a top 30 defense with the offense, it probably wins us a title. But, you know, do you, Where are you at on Lincoln Riley now? Like, if he decides to keep Grinch another year and the defense is terrible and Caleb wins a Heisman again and the defense prevents the team from making the playoff, how would you feel about him if that were the case?
It's a complicated situation because you have, I mean, look, Pete Carroll, it was like a very similar situation with Pete Carroll after 2004, because for whatever reason, his infinite wisdom, he decided to jettison the offensive coordinator that had just taken him to back-to-back national championships and replace him with, these two 30-year-old kids at the time. It's like, why are you doing that? It's totally unnecessary. And Pete was painfully slow in recognizing the changes that were happening to college football. He was not, I mean, at the same, it'd be funny if he had replaced Chow with like two 30-year-olds that were going to implement like the latest offense, but instead he replaced them with disciples of North Turner running essentially the 49ers offense from the late 80s. Just a bizarre decision. And on the defensive side, once it became clear that like more and more teams were switching to spread offenses, like his 4-3 defense, like cover 2-4-3 defense, just was not up to the task. And but that last season, 2009, that defense really started to struggle. And he was just painfully slow in making the adjustments, the changes he needed to make. And it was tough to watch. I don't know. Maybe I do get the sense that Lincoln knows this. He can't. There's no way you can sit on the sideline and think, "Oh, this is okay," or "Hey, my buddy's got this, and I'm not worried about it." I mean, it's
Right.
because the level of kind of ineptitude is so high. It's so obvious. I mean, like the first play of every series for like the last like for four series in a row, the first play was like at least 40 yards. I mean, it was a complete breakdown. Like, just you couldn't run. Like, they could run basic off tackle running plays, and we had no way they could throw a basic hook over the middle or slant, and like we couldn't. Not only did we not like stop the guy from catching it, but it was like the guy was running all the way to down the field for a touchdown because our guys were running into each other. So there's absolutely no way that Lincoln's seeing this thing. Oh, I guess it's just the personnel. To raise personnel is just too good for us. I mean, if high school guys were doing the exact same plays, those would have gained the exact same number of yards. I mean, these are just, it's a complete breakdown. So I don't know. To me, he'd have to explain what he's thinking in not making some drastic change, and to go along with that, like, this is NIL is like everything these days. What donor is going to be ponying up cash to bring in the like defensive players with Grinch as the defensive coordinator? No one's gonna like if you had, if you had, "Hey, I got like $100,000 to spare, that's all I got," and Lincoln Riley comes to you and says, "Hey, can we use this $100,000 so Alex Grinch can get a new safety?" Are you gonna say yes? Oh, sure, no problem. I mean, you might do it for a quarterback, but you're not going to do it for any defensive player as long as Alex Grinch is a defensive coordinator. So, I think there's just too many, I don't know, just too many problems.
And you're already seeing the effects on the 2024 recruiting class. Like, a lot of the defensive players, the top defensive players in Southern California, are leaning elsewhere right now. And, that could be, of course, NIL is a factor with this stuff. And, if the donors ponied up cash to keep them, they probably could. But, even it, as a player, right? Like, NIL is going to be a factor in any recruitment, but like, it would have to just be even more cash, right, to play for Grinch as opposed to playing for, a DC that had a proven track record. It would just, you'd have to offer him even more money to make up for the lack of coaching, so to speak, right?
Yeah,
So
and
it's
actually, and that goes a little bit too. I mean, I think Jim Leonard is a terrific defensive coordinator from what I can tell, but I don't think you necessarily need to go that level. I think you just need to get a guy who's respectable. I mean, probably makes sense to find someone who's going to run a four-man front, not a three-man front like Leonard runs. Because it's easier to recruit and we're already having trouble. I hate making coaching decisions around recruiting, but when we're having so many problems to begin with, you don't want to compound the problem. Just find somebody who runs a four-man front that and like NFL coaches will respect. That's all you need. Hey, this guy's respected, and like he'll get, you know, he'll develop you as a player. That's what you need. He will develop you as a player. No, none of these kids are thinking Alex Grinch is going to develop them because they watch the defense and it looks like a joke. So, you know, it doesn't matter how high in the draft Thule goes. I mean, players are not going to think they're going to get developed. I mean, it's just that simple.
Yeah. So let me put you on the spot here. Like how do you see this playing out, I guess, over the next two seasons? If you had to take a wild guess right now, just with USC football, kind of everything, offense, defense, any forecast?
I still think there's going to be some major thing done with the defense. I don't know if it's going to be Grinch gets fired or they bring in somebody else to coach with him or oversee him or what. I think something major will have to get done. You know, personnel wise, I think if we get a couple more guys, the team is actually lined up. I know you know, there's this historical precedent that you need X level of defense. Certainly like Georgia's kind of been demonstrating that as having this elite defense, but you know, like I think that because offenses are so good, I think you just need some level, as long as you win the games, you just need some level of like competency to be able to get some stops. I mean, TCU's defense was not like super great this season. I don't think, you know, I think Georgia will beat them, but you know, they were able to beat Michigan. If we can get just a little bit done on the defensive side, it's hard with Grinch back there, no matter what. I mean, I guess that's true, but you know, I could see us going undefeated next season. It's just so much going on. There's just so much uncertainty. The worst case scenario, obviously, is something bad happens next year. Caleb gets hurt, and then we have to rely on the defense. We have a very mediocre year, and Caleb's gone, and then we're, you know, in no man's land. I mean, that's also possible too. So it is a somewhat precarious time. I agree with that. But, you know, I'm not pessimistic about the future. I mean, it's funny because you thought going the season, you thought we had a great chance of the national championship. And I thought, or at least not winning it, but like, you know, getting into the college football playoff. And I was like, that's not really realistic. And we were right on the door knocking. But then when we lose the Cotton Bowl, it's kind of like along the lines of what I was thinking, which is like this team's personnel is not quite there. But I do think it's potential to be there next season, or at least very close. But I think there's going to be an inflection point here, and we're going to have to see if Lincoln's up to the task of making some tough decisions. So I don't know. Yeah,
I guess. You know, if Lincoln Riley decides to stick with Alex Grinch, I don't know how you could realistically say that Lincoln Riley cares about winning a national championship more than employing his friends. I mean, like, unless Lincoln's like that dumb, which I don't think he is, right? Like, I don't know how you can come to, you know, a conclusion outside of that.
I think the thing is, I mean, you get in this situation because, by the way, just really quickly, and we'll circle back to this in a second.
Yeah.
TCU is 64th in the country in yards per play allowed. So that's just put a pin in that for a second. For Lincoln may just not, because he came up through first Mike Leach coach teams, and then having Bob Stoops' brother as the defensive coordinator, he was coaching alongside with both as a coordinator and then as a head coach. And then relying on Grinch because of the Mike Leach recommendation, he may just not feel comfortable enough with somebody. Like, he's just not coached in enough places with enough good defensive coordinators. I mean, that is honestly, I think that's like an authentic thing. Now, if I were he, as a result of that, I'd probably be like, okay, but I've coached against these XY guy, this guy's impressed me, so maybe he should be looking like in that sense. He should be looking, okay, well, this is someone who's impressed me. But my guess is that Grinch is like the best he's ever worked with, is the problem. He just has I mean, he's worked with a lot of great offensive coaches, but when it comes to defense, he hasn't really experienced a lot of coaches that I think have impressed him, and Grinch is probably at the top of the list. And it's like, once you get rid of him, it's like you're in no man's land. I mean, what if you bring in a guy who, and he's like a complete idiot compared to what his reputation is? And that's things like that have happened. So I'm guessing that's where he's coming from.
So let me throw two questions at you. One, do you think Lincoln Riley believes he can win a national title with Grinch as his DC?
Yes.
Okay. And then two, would Alex Grinch be employed by USC right now making $2 million or whatever he makes if he wasn't close friends personally with Lincoln Riley?
The answer is basically no, but I could definitely see a scenario where he had hoodwinked Bone into giving, you know, to bring him on with Clay Helton still around, you know, like I could see a hoodwink situation. After this season, no.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess we'll see how it plays out, right? But I don't really get it. You know, I could easily see a scenario too where like USC drops a couple games because of the defense this year, then miss the playoff. Grinch gets one more year, and because Malachi Nelson just isn't as good as Caleb Williams, they go like 9-3 or 8-4 in the first Big Ten season, right? And then like, then where are you at, right? Just it's at that point it would be like, oh, it's all Caleb and Lincoln Riley just wasted 3 years.
That's true. I mean, that's
on Alex Grinch.
That's absolutely true, but there's also the transfer portal. So I mean, you know,
Okay. No, they will have to be really reliant on the portal, right? Like we've kind of talked about this 2023 class. Like you don't have a ton of like, you know, impact high school dudes on the defensive side of the ball right now, like coming in. It's not like, you know, you've got Maluga and Cushing and these guys kind of coming up, you know, in the next few years or anything like that, right? And part of that, I think, is the Grinch factor. I mean, you can't trust it, whereas it's a lot easier to buy in if you're Zach Branch or Malachi Nelson or Mekhi
Lyons. Oh, that's 100% true. That's 100% true. Okay, before we get out of here, let's just do a quick call on. I mean, look, it's a 15-point. UCLA's 15-point favorite. Let's like make the pretend line 7.5 points. Who are you taking? USC, UCLA, 7.5 point line.
I would lean UCLA. I think it's probably like a 10-point loss. I think that's where I'm at.
I'm with you. But let's hope for better tomorrow night. Yep. I think the game starts at 7:30 Pacific time or 6:30 Pacific time. I'm not sure. Anyway, check your schedules. Big game. Anything more before we get out of here?
No, I think we covered a lot here. So good to be back. And you know, happy New Year again to everybody.
Yep, and fight on, everyone. Fight on.